I want to especially welcome people who are new to freelancing and or new to SEJ. I hope you have a really good experience. This conference is a great chance to learn things, to meet people, to build a network that will help you even when you're not here. You know, people you can ask about things on the listserv or directly, people who can point you to other groups that are useful. So really do, you know, talk to people as much as you can. Take advantage of all of the great company that's here during the four days or however long you're here for this. You're going to find as we go through the day and we talk about different angles on freelancing that there is no one formula for how to do this. If there was, whoever had written it would be rich and popular. But there's no one right way, and many people have their own very distinct ways of doing things that work for them. Some people may talk about doing things in ways that totally break the rules that you've seen. And, you know, and that's okay. So, you know, if you have a way of doing things that's different, please share it, because people all really have to sort of figure out what works for them and make their own kind of operating plan. One resource that's really helpful to you, though, that I want to point out is the Science Writer's Handbook. You will see this all around at the conference. It's at the conference bookstore. It was written by a network of science writers who made themselves into a network. They basically created their own community. Several of them are here. Who's in silence? Sarah, Emma, Susan. Emily, right? Where's Emily? Emily's next door. Okay, yeah. So anyway, so a number of the people who are in this little sort of homemade network wrote this terrific book, which is an awesome resource on science writing and freelancing, including things like business, managing your money, publicizing yourself, doing all kinds of things like that. So this is a great resource. There's some bookmarks and postcards on it that I will send around as soon as I sit down. Let's see. Oh, I wanted to just explain what some of these pictures are, too. This is a photograph that Tom Yulzman, who's an SEJ board member and does a photo blog for Discover, sent of stormy skies near his home over Boulder. As you know, it's been stormy in Boulder lately. But we also have some other nice illustrations here showing that skies can clear and things can look better. You know, we just thought it'd be nice to have some visuals to look at besides all of us up here. And we have the Science Writer's Handbook, and this is the thing that will really clear your skies. So there we go with some... Let me see, I don't know how to get back out of that, but someone else can help me with that. I am just going to go ahead and turn it over to our first panel, Dan Grossman and Jim Motivalli, who are going to talk about how to get it going, really, in their own ways. We're going to have a lot of time for questions, so they're going to do fairly short presentations, and this session is being recorded so that people who couldn't be here will be able to download it or get a podcast or some version of it from SEJ. So when we go to questions, we will hand microphones around. And just I will remind people of this when we do questions, but please try to keep your questions brief, and they have to end with a question mark. Please don't make speeches about things because that makes more time for everybody to hear and learn stuff. So I'm going to let you guys introduce yourselves, or you can introduce each other. However you would like to do it, just tell your background and go right ahead. Can you stand up or use this?
Okay. Well, I couldn't possibly introduce Jim because there would be too many things to say, so I'll focus on myself for the moment, and then he can introduce himself. Yeah. I'm just going to put in my memory stick here because I was tweaking my presentation this morning, as I like to do, as I often do, so we'll just... How do I get... Yeah. Where's the desktop? Is this the... So we're waiting for it to come up. There we go. Okay. Yeah. There we go. Okay. So thank you very much for... well, thanks for whoever invited me to for doing so. I'm really glad to be here. I was planning to be in the audience. Uh-oh.
I have a
can I just, why don't I just
on, that I downloaded.
No, that's okay.
Just put that in. Excellent plan.
Okay. Sorry about that.
We're freelancers. We're not tech support. Yeah.
Now, the problem is, of course, I sent this to them earlier, but I like to tweak, so that's the problem. But hopefully this will Now you've got to. I have to apologize. This is my daughter's computer, so if there's something funky on here, it's her fault. Here we go. Yeah, now I got the audio cable in here. Okay. Let's see. All right. Okay. So, I've been a freelance journalist basically my entire journalism career. Started doing magazine writing in 1986 or so, and I gradually built up and started off while I was in graduate school, did more and more writing, not journalism school, and moved into radio, and initially in magazine, moved into radio, and then since then I've sort of done a lot of multimedia journalism. I built some websites, and I've also branched into video. And in the process, I've come up with a model that I think it works for me. And as the airline, as the advertisements like to say, your mileage will vary. I can't say that this particular model would work for you, but I'm hoping that some of the things that I've thought of and some of the ways that I approach my work might be helpful to some of you, and might help you to think about how to be be more successful or have more fun or make more money or whatever your goals are in your journalism. So I talk about my business model. When I started out 25 or so years ago, I hadn't really heard the term business model. I didn't think about it. I had a mentor who was a couple years ahead of me in freelance journalism, and I just followed what he was doing, and I thought that I didn't think that I needed sort of to have a big idea about what I was going to do or how I was going to do it. But I highly recommend thinking about that, and I was tempted to say times have changed, but probably times have not changed that much. It's just that you guys can be smarter than me. So we all started journalism. When I started, journalism was all print. I shouldn't say that. When I started as a print journalist, and there wasn't any internet back then. I used something called Zap Mail that MCI had, which was precursor to email. And I think that a lot of people, even outside of the print journalism, like in radio, let's say, still have a kind of a print journalism view of how they're going to work, how they're going to make their money as freelancers, and we all know that times have changed with the internet and with mobile devices and all these other things, and yet we still continue to work in the same old ways without realizing that it may not be the best way to go or may not work. And so this is what I used to do. My model for being a freelancer was that I was going to be sending out query letters. And if it didn't work, I would write another query letter or rework the query letter. And I was constantly going to magazine racks and trying to find magazines that might be interested in the stories that I was working on and reworking that. And I had some I had some successes. I wrote something for Rolling Stone, just one thing. Then the guy came back from his leave or something like that. That had the regular slot. That was the last thing I sold to them. I wrote things for the Boston Globe, Sunday Magazine, the Boston Globe, Discover Magazine, Earth Magazine, Garbage Magazine, when there was such a thing. But I realized that this approach is not necessarily that lucrative. It can be lucrative for some people. It's also really annoying, even for the people, I think, who it's lucrative for. It's a really annoying way to do things. You kind of sit around, wait for the editor to process your query letter, and then it could be weeks or even months later. I had one instance with Smithsonian where during the course of I sent in a query letter with someone who I'd actually met. And over the subsequent year, first, it was in the middle of the pile for a long time. I called him every 2 months. It was in the middle of the pile. And then there was a change in the top editor, so everything was had to be reconsidered. And so it was still in the middle of the pile. And then they moved offices, and that changed things around. And then at some point he had a heart attack, and I had to wait for a while he recovered from his heart attack. And then when he came back, I tried him again. And then 9/11 happened, and that was that they redid all their plans. And then the guy retired, and they couldn't find my query letter. So that's just the most egregious case. So this is my old model for how I thought about things. So the journalist produces some journalism and sends that to the publisher. The publisher goes to the public and they send some money back to me. Now, this is my alternative way. The idea here is that I've got a better way the outlet is still important to me, but I've got a better way of getting connected with those outlets. So I'm going to talk about my business model and sort of the project, the fact that I'm project based and what that means. So this is so that we got the old business model we're not going to do anymore, and this is my new business model, which is I'm here in the middle, and this idea is that rather than kind of all the focus being on the publisher and I'm the supplicant. Instead, I'm going to try to think of myself as being the center of attention, the big player, as if you will, so that I'm not as in as weak a position all the time. And I have to work with the media because that's how I get an audience. But I work with lots of them. So I'm working with a variety of outlets in a variety of media. I work in many different media, and so that helps. But you see the arrows going back, the little money signs going back are smaller in this case. There's more of them, but they're smaller. And these guys are all happy because I'm providing them good stuff. And the reason the money signs are smaller is I get some money from somewhere else. So from foundations, from government agencies, from nonprofits, even from some individuals. And those are the source of at least some or even a good portion of the money that comes in. The kind of money you can get can be salary money, and if you can get a big grant, that's terrific. And I have gotten some big grants. If nothing else, it's really. Everybody here knows that getting a grant for, let's say, travel from the Center Fund for Investigative Journalism or the SEJ Fund for Journalism is a good idea, but I think at some point I realized it's not just, okay, I want to go somewhere, I'm going to get some money. The point is, once you have that money, once you're in a place that no one else is reporting from and have a story that no one else has, you're in a much better position to go to these editors and publishers and say, this is what I've got. So you're no longer begging for them to take a look at your query letter. And, of course, the audience, you've got a bigger and diverse audience using this approach. And the way I think of this now is I'm not thinking of I've got a story to sell. That was the old model. I've got a story. I do a lot of research for this story, maybe a couple of weeks coming up with a query letter about this one great idea. And I do whatever I can to sell that one idea to some institution. Instead, it's a whole project. So I'm going to spend a year working on something, and I'm going to get some money that's going to pay expenses, maybe pay me a salary to really get up to speed on that, to do the travel it takes to report on that, and then to put that together and produce some great stuff. Now I'm going to go back for a second because one thing I didn't mention was that the interests of these various groups in here. You see, the outlets are always important for me. The World, which is one of the outlets I use a lot. It's super important. I want people to hear my stuff on there, but it's not the money that I want from them. And this is where this is a kind of thinking that developed over some time. I don't need money from them, or I don't need much money from them. It's always nice to get money, but if I go to Peru and report on on glaciers melting in Peru, they don't have the money for that. The kind of money they're paying me is peanuts, really. And so, the kind of money a radio story for the World might pay $600, let's say, and maybe I'll get two or three stories. So we're talking about $1,200. $1,800, and I spent 3 weeks reporting in Peru. Obviously, it doesn't that doesn't count the time to actually produce the stories back in the United States. But I need them because no one's going to give me money to do that if I don't have an audience. So for me, I think of these outlets as the conduit, not as the source of money. And the money's at the bottom mostly. So let me go continue on my way here. So just to give you some examples of what I mean when I talk about projects. So I did this big project on Madagascar a few years ago, and I got a few grants to go to Madagascar. I went to Madagascar twice and produced a big website for WBUR. And I had a whole bunch of outputs from that. And I spent about a year working on Madagascar, and I built a website for WBUR. I did a radio documentary for Radio Netherlands. I did some radio features, let's say 10-minute features. And I got grants I got some money from WBUR. I got grants from various foundations. I want to encourage you to be, I'm actually not up here to encourage you to do anything. I'm just going to tell you what I do, and you can figure out whether it works for you. I'll just give you one example, okay, of this Nancy Kutu Memorial Fund. I feel like I'm pretty entrepreneurial. You can judge for yourselves, but the Nancy Kutu Memorial Fund was actually some fund set up by someone who had a family member who, in the Peace Corps, who died, was murdered in Madagascar, and I heard about this fund, and it was basically just sitting there, and I told them about all the great work I was going to do in Madagascar, and they gave me a small grant. So you got to look around and see where you can, where there are sources of money. So there's a, I just got a few more minutes, but there's, this is a website I did on Antarctica. Again, this one was with WBUR. I spent a lot of time, a lot of time learning about Antarctica, in particular the Antarctic Peninsula, and I spent 6 weeks or a month down there, plus a week each way getting there, and it produced a whole bunch of different products. So I had the website for WBUR, I had a documentary features, some interviews, which I don't think they paid, and then I got support from various places. To make that work. This is my latest project, which is on sea level rise. I produced a website.
Earth is like an onion with three major concentric layers.
That's my new website. And then there were a whole bunch of different things that went with that. So I spent a long time learning about various aspects of sea level rise, in particular one area of research. I produced that website, some short videos, this TED book. Some of these things didn't pay money, but they were important for the funders. Got book reviews, which gives an added audience, interviews, excerpts from the book. And I got funding from a variety of places. I'm sure a lot of you have thought of this already or think this way, but I didn't really think this much too hard about this initially, and it's important to think of various revenue streams. You can get a variety of sources of income that together hopefully will add up to something. So the grants I was talking about, the freelance payments, which might not be that big, but it still helps. Speakers' fees, if you're an expert on something, you're gonna get speakers' fees. I don't make a whole lot that way, but I do make some, and so that's helpful. And then, of course, if people know about your work, In a certain area, some things may get republished. People might want to publish some of your pictures or excerpt things of yours or other things like that. So those help to make the bottom line add up. The special sauce here, which I think that people can ask about if they want later or come up to me later. It's in terms of how to make this work. First, you gotta have your outlets. You gotta always be looking for new outlets. You have to convince them you're doing some really cool stuff. And same thing with the funding sources. And you have to balance this timing thing is how do you work out the relationship between your outlets and your funding sources? Because outlets aren't interested in you if you're not doing this great reporting, and funding sources aren't interested in you if you don't have the outlets. So you got to balance those things. When you're applying for a grant, you have to say, I think I got this outlet, and you go to the outlet and you get, I think I got this money, and then hopefully you can convince them that if they both say yes, that you'll be that things are going to things are going to work out. Innovation, you got to come up with new ideas, this TED book I did. It was helpful for funding. TED was interested because I had a multimedia. They were just starting an app book. Mine was the second app book that TED put out. Collaborators. I've been working with the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting for many years now. They're a great collaborator. They add to my... they make me look more serious for a funder, very helpful. And being entrepreneurial, always looking around for who might be, where you might, a new source of funding, a new place to put stuff out. So what's good about all this? Well, you won't get kicked around anymore, hopefully, or not so much. You got to think big, like projects, not individual stories. At least that's what I like to do. You got to find those sources of money and find your collaborators. Okay, thank you. the other computer back. Oh, here it is. Oh, is it on the, is it on this?
No, that's not it. Your name. Is it this one, money?
It should be in there. I don't think that's mine. I think that's Dan's, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was in that folder.
Yeah.
Okay. I can live without it.
Stand by.
Stick.
Okay, just do that.
Oh, you know what? Here, I've got it.
Well, the stick might be the
easiest
way.
It
could be that, must, that, okay. That when I downloaded it, I took it off.
All right.
Here. Sorry about that. That was, it is my fault. It's not my fault, though. Here's more.
All right. Good morning, everybody. I'm Jim Motivalli. A lot of you know me. I've been coming to SCJ forever. And guess when I decided to become a freelancer? The worst possible year to become a freelancer. What would that year be? 2008. I became a freelancer. I thought it'd be good to go through a little bit of my career before that to show how I got set up as a freelancer. I very much followed the old paradigm as a reporter. I started out at a community weekly, which I think is a great way to be a reporter. It's where you do everything, the school lunch menu and the police reports, and you're the photographer, and you write the editorials, and you take the photographs. And that, to me, was a great training ground. I worked at Save the Children Federation for a year or two, learning how to do multimedia stuff, which came in very handy. I became an alternative newspaper editor for a number of... I better wear my glasses. I became a alternative newspaper editor at a time when those papers were flourishing. You know, I worked at the new mass media papers in Massachusetts and Connecticut, and I got a lot of work in investigative journalism that way, which is really a lot of fun. And I think maybe I saw that that particular business model was not going to last forever. And I segued from there into environmental journalism, specifically as the editor of E, the environmental magazine. And I was editor of E for 12 years. And then I saw the handwriting on that particular wall, the whole sort of print magazine supported by foundations. So in some ways, at that point, my career dovetails a little bit with what Dan does, because we raised foundation money to publish our cover stories. And I was very involved in that. I wrote a lot of grant applications, which has nothing to do with what I do now, but I did that for quite a long time. I was an executive editor at that newspaper chain for a while, and then in 2008, when I really saw alternative newspapers dying, I decided to become a freelancer. And initially, my idea was, in partnership, was to build up a magazine called Business and the Environment. And it was going to be supported by the universities. And a partner and I came up with a plan for that. We even had covers. We had sample stories. We built this whole thing. And we first approached Yale. This happened to be the week that Yale discovered it had lost 20% of its endowment. This is the week we went to see Yale. And but, you know, the funny thing is that this all worked out. It didn't work out that week. I'm not partnered with Yale, but it could have worked out. It would have worked out, I think, in another time, another season, because it was a great idea. Okay. I'll get to what eventually happened with that later. So, 2008, I decided to become a freelancer, and it was initially, I had this sort of total oh my God moment. I mean, this isn't going to work. I can't be a full-time freelancer. I have no idea how to do this. I've never really been a freelancer. I've been a staff reporter for like 30 years. And I was used to the security blanket of that, you know, the paycheck, the health benefits. I really didn't know how to be a freelancer, so I had to build up an understanding of the new paradigm of how that was going to work. And I think part of what I think I'd established through 30 years of reporting was a certain brand. And I'd already written maybe five books, I think, by that point. And I think that does help establish your name in as a freelance writer. They do have some sense of who you are. And my books were mostly, almost all of them, environmental books. So I don't think I had the necessary confidence. Fortunately, my wife had a lot of confidence. She said, "You were born to do this. You've been working towards this your whole life. This is what you should do. You are going to do. You're going to be great at it." And so I listened to her. It's always been a good idea in my life. Listen to her. So I started out building a brand. And what I had initially was, this is right around the same time the New York Times launched its blog, its Wheels blog. And I'm a car writer, so I decided I was going to concentrate on that. I'd done all kinds of reporting, all kinds of environmental reporting, but I decided that my field would be the greening of the auto industry. And there weren't a whole lot of reporters in that. And it fit neatly with the new New York Times blog, and they wanted me to write about that. And despite it being the New York Times, it paid $100 a post. And I had not been used to getting that low an amount of money. I should point out that I'd been a freelancer pretty much the whole time I was a staffer. So I wasn't exactly new to freelancing. I'd done a lot of it. But from the security of a staff job. And so I'd written for the New York Times since the early 90s. But this was their foray into online reporting in the auto space. So I decided I was going to really do a lot of that. But I was used to getting like $800 or $1,000 for Time stories. And whatever you write for the New York Times requires a certain amount of rigor. So you do a lot of work for $100. So that was new. But what I wanted to do, I didn't want to be a pitch journalist. I didn't want to be based on writing pitches. So what I evolved was the concept that basically, I would find places that would let me write maybe two stories a week and then pay me a monthly stipend. And right around this time, I got contacted by Mother Nature Network, which was a new startup in Atlanta. And they said, "Do you want to write for us?" And my wife said, "Don't do it. They don't pay enough. No one's ever heard of them." And this is an occasion where I did not listen to her. And it was actually good that I didn't, because that's been a very fruitful arrangement. I've written for them for 5 years. Pluginkars.com is another one. I write two a week. They pay me a monthly stipend. It's basically everything's basically $100 a post. The New York Times credential has really opened a lot of doors for me. In a lot of ways, writing for the Times is more hassle than it's worth. It causes a lot of grief in my life. Like, I can't take any junkets because the Times has ethics policies about that. So it's not the easiest thing, but in terms of, I hate using the word brand, but I think it is important. I think you do have to recognize that you have a brand as a freelancer, and that really builds your brand, in addition to writing books and things like that. So this is sort of the new paradigm that I've had to work with. This is the reality of the journalism space today. So this is what I do today. I do lots of blogging at $100 a post. I do write for a business magazine, Success, which pays very well. And I do have to mention this because I think it's an important area that some of you could get into. I write reports for the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And this is essentially what happened with Business and the Environment, the magazine I pitched to the Yale. My business partner had a connection with the University of Pennsylvania, so we took it down there, and they were also not going to launch a magazine in the worst recession in America for like 50 years. But they did have something called iGel, which was their environmental arm, and they were interested in having reports written about their conferences and things like that. And these are big scale, 10,000 word reports on things like supply, greening the supply chain, or I did one on urban mobility. I've actually done 10 of them. And it's quite a lucrative area for me now. And I have maybe three or four of them stacked up. One was on Japan, different aspects of Japan. One was on Indonesia, environmental things there. And I've since actually partnered with two other universities on projects like this. And I continue to do a radio show. I've been on the air for 40 years. And I do lectures. I think having a book is a great jumping off point to have a career as a talking head. And I've been doing that a lot. It's funny, we were talking yesterday about how essentially your work tapers off. Like, you can sort of look at it as a timeline. Within 6 months of writing the book, you get a lot of speaking gigs. Within a year, it's tapering off. Within 2 years, no one remembers your book. But it is good to do that. Books, again, don't pay a whole lot. It's been difficult in this economy, but I think I've done 8 books now, and that's a good thing for me. So this is what I try to do in the way I write. And I think it's important. I try not to say no a lot. I think reporters tend to do that. And as an editor myself for 30 years, I know that if someone says no to me, I'm less likely to call them back. I know it's going to be difficult when you've got a lot of work piled up and you don't see how you can do one more assignment to say no. But I recommend not saying no, simply because of the way editors think. And I do repurpose stories when I can. I do try to understand what the editors want, and I do try to write to the audience. I don't use unexplained acronyms. I explain whenever I mention some organization that I don't think the audience knows, I explain what it is. I use graphics and video. I try to make the stuff colorful and lively. And these to me are some of the key things you need to do. I think it's very important to have a niche as a writer. For me, green car writing is very, very focused type thing. And I think when editors think of that topic, they think of me. And I haven't written a query letter in probably 3 years, 4 years. And I get a lot of work over the transom from people who want green car writing. And as a freelancer, consistently, I've made probably double or sometimes even triple what I made as a staff writer each year without writing pitch letters. So I'm very happy with that result. I think every writer in the room is not totally secure with what they do. What if my outlets disappear tomorrow? It can happen, right? Everything disappears. Life is built on unstable ground. But I think I built something that's about as stable as you can get and still be a freelancer. And that's what not to do. Say to newspaper, you really have to have environmental reporting. It's important. Expect them to pay attention to that. I don't think that's going to work. I think you have to write quickly, too. It's part of the new paradigm. Is you can't take forever to turn something out. And that's me. I'm looking forward to a lively discussion on these issues. And let's talk.
Okay, so we're going to have lots of questions, I'm sure. Susan and I will take the wireless mics around to the opposite sides, if that's okay with you guys, so you'll have to use the one up here to reply. But...
Bernardo Mott from Bridgewater College. A question that I have is, both of you, when you start your careers as freelancers, you already have a name in the business on the old paradigm, and the other one because you worked a lot as a paid staff reporter. Okay, sorry. How would someone who doesn't have a reputation in the business would create that reputation to start selling stories and projects?
I could just say something about that, then maybe Dan can jump in. I think in that case, you do have to show that you're really good, and you probably do have to write the stuff ahead of time. You know, it's the same thing as if you're a novelist. You can't just send somebody an outline for a novel when you're an unknown novelist and expect them to publish it. You have to write the novel, essentially. They're going to buy the book. In this case, I think you have to create the work and show, and by the sheer strength of it, get it purchased, and then you're starting to build a name. That's my thought on that.
I do think there are some institutions that take it upon themselves to help people who are starting off in their career. Like, I think some of the, well, occasionally I'll see grants that are specifically for young journalists, and so I would, that's one place I would look, because again, I think that if you've got something unique, something that no one else is offering, then you have a much better chance of interesting somebody in taking a chance on that. At some point in my career, rather late, I realized that it just wasn't going to be possible for me to, you know, I'm from Boston. I almost never write anything that has to do with New England or anywhere nearby, just because I decided that there's too much competition. And I think that a young, someone coming into the business can use that same approach if they can find some way to get a story or report from a place that it's harder to get material from.
Hi, I'm Roger Archibald from Boston as well, and this is for Dan. I'm curious, you mentioned in your that one of your revenue streams was actually, salaried positions with organizations. I guess avoid the potential conflict of interest that might arise. I know Jim mentioned that the New York Times says you can't go on gigs. I'm wondering, if you had done a salaried position and tried to sell the same story to the New York Times, would they have a problem with that? It might see it more as a public relations than journalism?
Right.
If you could just comment on that a little bit.
I haven't had any salaried positions. I'm not sure exactly what you're thinking of, but there are ethical issues that I worry about, think about, have to deal with. I think the best example would be this TED book I did. I got funded, so it wasn't salary, but I was funded through a grant to work with a researcher who was at the time at BU and is now at Columbia, and we got this grant together. It was her grant. Actually, she was the principal investigator. So technically, you could say she was my boss. I produced that website that I produced was paid for by that grant, and technically she was the boss. She could tell me if, I mean, she didn't exert a whole lot of editorial control, but she could tell me what could be on there and what could not be on there. Now the TED book, if I do anything else on that research, one could say, okay, you got a conflict of interest. That I felt for when I wrote the TED book, of course, different institutions deal with this in a different way, and so TED Books wasn't interested, didn't care one whit about that. And in my book, for the purposes of my readers, I said, here's the book was basically almost a profile of her. And she comes off looking okay, but it's not a puff piece. I don't feel like it's a puff piece. I didn't want my readers to be fooled, though. I wanted them to know that actually I had worked with her. So I dealt with that in a way that I thought was ethical, but I didn't have any problems with the publication institution. It could come up in other sorts of institutions, but I'll give you an example of a way that I feel pretty happy about that I think is kind of clever for dealing with another similar problem. I'm applying for a grant right now with another researcher. I'm actually going to be a principal investigator as part of this grant. It'll be an NSF grant if we get funded, and so to some extent, anything I produce from that project will again be a certain kind of public relations. So the question is, well, how am I going to? I mean, I can produce a website. Anybody can produce a website, but how am I going to get other possible outlets for that? Because as part of the grant application, I wanted other possible outlets, and so I came up with this idea that I would pitch some radio stories. This grant is going to be, it's involved some research in Antarctica. It's a pretty interesting field work. So the idea I came up with was, what if I produced stories from one of the researchers, or for one of the researchers? In other words, I worked as a producer, not as the journalist. So in a certain sense, it would be the first person account of the researcher. And the radio institution, my pitch to the radio institution was that everybody assumes that if someone's talking about themselves and their own research, that they're biased in their own favor. And they understand that, and so there's no particular reason why they shouldn't allow that, because the audience understands that. So I'm operating as the producer, so I don't have, there's not that question of am I fooling anybody? Because that's the real issue. Does the audience understand what's going on? So that's one way I solve that problem.
Emma here. I just wanted to mention that this kind of ethics question that arises when you have a bunch of different revenue streams from different places is sort of exactly the stuff that we're hoping to tackle in our ethics session this afternoon. So I hope you'll be there for that, and we can talk about it more. But yeah, I think that the more freelancers diversify, the more they have to deal with these knots. And I'm certainly having some of my own struggles, which I will tell you about this afternoon.
You know, I have this sort of, maybe we can talk more about this in the ethics thing, but as I do these reports for Wharton, they're underwritten by corporations, and it hasn't really presented any conflicts for me. But if, say, an auto company were to underwrite one of them, then I think I might have some issues. It's the kind of thing the Times worries about a lot. And if you're concerned about protecting your work at the Times, you do sort of get concerned about these things, or whether they, and I've never had the editors worry about or actually be specifically concerned about it, but I always mention it to them if I think there might be an area there.
Hi. I was wondering how you generate your ideas for yourself. How do you choose? I think I'll do a year-long project on Madagascar, or how do you focus your thinking about future projects and getting grants, that sort of thing?
Go ahead. Oh, okay. Well, in terms of car writing, I think it's great. Once you get established, and this is another reason I think it's important to have a niche, because you get approached a lot with people who have ideas and concepts and want to give you scoops and all kinds of things like that. And that's very helpful, because I like to break stories, so I don't want to just... You know, some people have asked me, you write like 10 stories a week, do you do a lot of these sort of Me Too type of pieces, piggybacking on things other people have written? And I hate doing that. I really don't intend to do that. I also tend to interview people for blog posts, which I know is a new concept, you know. But I still like to get them done in an hour. So it's helpful to have your name out there as someone who writes a lot in that space. So you're the person they're going to go to when they have some sort of concept they think is worth. And, you know, I obviously have a lot of other ways of getting stories, but that's very helpful.
In this regard, Jim and I are polar opposites, because I have absolutely no interest in news, and no one ever pitches me anything. All of my ideas for pieces have come from my own research. And I'm not sure if I can tell you that much about it, just because it's very idiosyncratic. But what I look for is something... I mean, I want something that has lasting value. That's one thing. So news doesn't matter that much. It matters a little bit, but it has to be something with lasting value, on the order of a year or more. I'm looking for something that hasn't been done, see, my major focus is on climate change. I mean, that's my niche. And so my mission in life is to educate the public on this. And so I'm looking for something that will add to the discussion of the area. So I'm looking for something that's within the climate change science realm, that hasn't been done before, that has lasting value, that has a good storytelling potential.
I'm Alan Best. I'm out of Colorado, and my question is for Jim primarily, and it's about your book writing. How do you juggle your time to make sure you get the chapters over the finish line, and once you've gotten the book out and you're trying to make some money from public speaking, how do you go about that? What kind of fees do you expect, that sort of thing?
As I said, I think book writing is very helpful to your brand, and it does help you get speaking things. It does take you away from your regular work, and it does mean you work very hard in the periods where you have a book under development. And it's hard to squeeze it in, but I've always managed to do that. And I produce about 10 blog posts a week, so also doing a book on top of that, plus reports for Wharton and radio and all this other stuff. It's, you know, my wife would rather I be home more, or not working, because I'm working when I'm home. I mean, there's no clear, clean way of just fitting in a book. You know, it takes up a lot of time. I mean, you just have to sort of work around it and get to it. In terms of speaking fees, I tend to work with the organizations that want to hire me, because they have vastly different expectations about what they intend to pay you. And I want them to state a number at first, because if you come up with something, you've probably left money on the table. And they'll say, I find the ones that pay the most are the most embarrassed about it. They'll say, I'm sorry, we did our best, but we've only got $5,000 to pay you, and I know you usually work for more, which is not true at all, but we can offer you that. And if I just came up with a number, it would have been lower than that. So don't do that. Don't throw out a number before they do. I would recommend that. But speaking is great. I had this agent once, the brief time I had an agent for speaking, and he had turned down this thing in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, because it only paid $2,000. And he said it was beneath you. I said, no, it wasn't. I would have done it in a minute. You're an idiot. That was the last thing he represented me on. I've still never been to Jackson Hole, Wyoming. I'd love to go there.
My name is Stuart Moore. I'm from Middle Tennessee. I pitched an idea to a magazine recently and had a great intro from a well-known writer in Nashville. And the editor wouldn't respond to my emails or phone calls. And I know you got to be thick-skinned, but the way I was raised, that's unprofessional and rude. How do you handle, or as having been an editor, Daniel, persistence as opposed to someone being just obnoxious? I mean, is there a line between I'm driven and passionate and I want to be heard to that next realm? Thank you so much.
Well, I think that everybody in this room has probably experienced this. It's a condition of modern life. And when I don't get an email back from someone, I think that there's three hypotheses that I balance in my mind. One is that they never got my email for whatever reason, got lost, they didn't notice it. The other one is that they responded either positively or negatively, but I didn't get their email. And the third one is they got my email and they rudely didn't respond to it. And that's the one I tend to, in my darkest moments, tend to gravitate toward. But it's actually not that helpful to do that. And I think I could teach a course on journalism correspondence, including writing query or query-like emails, and also dealing with this precise problem. And I've come up with all sorts of language to cushion to politely try to urge someone to get back to me. I have often found that people didn't get back to me that I've waited a long time and there's a good explanation for it, or that someone actually likes to be reminded. And so I have a tendency to want to tell someone to F off when they didn't respond to multiple emails, but that never does anything useful. What I do is, after a certain period of time, I write an email saying, I sent you an email recently, but I understand you're very busy. It's quite possible also that my email got lost in cyberspace or in your very busy inbox. So you do it like real gentle touch, and that rarely is that problematic that I reminded someone after a period of weeks, because you do need to give people time. I do that all the time, and sometimes I discover that someone didn't actually get my email. I also it's not a bad idea after a certain period of time. I also will follow up with a phone call. I might send an email and say I'm going to give you a call in a few days. It's really the whole process is really annoying, but I wouldn't give up, and I would just continue to be polite. And you got to assume that they're acting in good faith, even if you know they may not be.
Well, just speaking as an editor for 30 years, sometimes the volume of queries can be rather overwhelming. In the old days of paper queries, I had a stack like this on my desk, and if I didn't respond to them immediately, which is what I tried to do, soon something was on top of that query, and soon that query was under a foot of stuff. So in those cases, actually, the follow-up call or email was kind of useful, because they would remind me of something that I saw that I meant to respond to but didn't. I think repeatedly calling an editor just gets annoying, so you're probably not helping your cause any. In the old days of the paper query, I would have people send me like 10 sheets of slides along with their query. And then a few weeks later, I would get this agitated call about the slides. So they were the only copies of the slides, and they wanted the slides back. And don't send the only copy of your slides to an editor. That is not a good idea. Luckily, we don't have to worry about that anymore. Actually, it's easier for editors to respond with email than it was in the old telephone days. So I think editors really should respond quickly to queries, but they don't. It's a fact of life you have to accept. It's not going to change. And it is rude, but c'est la vie.
Hi, I'm Brian Calvert. I'm a TED Scripps Fellow this year. This is a question for Dan. When you're applying for to be a PI in an NSF grant, for example, are you doing that under sort of like public education, or how do you become a PI on an NSF grant?
Well, I haven't yet been a PI on an NSF grant. This will be the second grant that I'm involved in, but the first one where I'm a PI. The NSF, the earlier grant, very briefly, the NSF used to have a specific. Well, NSF has a program in informal science education. Informal science education is, well, they have an education directorate, which deals with science education, and there's various ways that they encourage science education. One of those, well, they divide it up between formal, which has to do with school, and informal, which is like all the media and conferences, who knows, all different things. And there used to be a grant where a scientist could apply. Scientists who had some NSF funding already could apply to supplement their grant to do some outreach, what they call outreach education, about that. And that was the earlier grant. Unfortunately, they no longer have that, but they're still very interested in that. They're very interested in letting the public know what they're doing. They want the public for a couple of reasons. One is many of them are idealistic about science, and they think the public should know about it. And they think that science is important for people to understand. Second, they want, some of them may be loath to admit this, but I'm talking about people at the NSF. It's a form of advertising. I mean, want the people to know that the NSF paid for stuff. Because it's important that people are aware that the NSF actually does something important, because they get a lot of money, or relatively a lot of money, from the federal government. But there are still ways to get. Even though this other grant doesn't exist anymore, there are ways to get involved in outreach. And that's what I'm doing right now. And when I realized that this other grant didn't exist anymore, I started thinking about the idea of actually collaborating on a project, because all grantees are supposed to have what's called when a grant is considered by the NSF, a science grant, it's got to have the particular scientific stuff that they're doing, and I forget what that's called, but that's one category. Then there's another category they consider, which is called broader impacts. So broader impacts could be anything other than the particular stuff they're studying or hope to discover or whatever. So broader impact may be that graduate students get trained, or there's new techniques that could be useful in other fields, or public outreach. A broader impact is the public understands what they're doing. A lot of scientists aren't that interested in broader impacts, so it's an afterthought. They want the money for the stuff they want to study, but they know that broader impacts are going to be considered. So they might just sort of stick something on there or they may work harder and try to come up with something really good. If you go to someone who's about to apply for a grant and you can say, I wonder if I could be part of your broader impacts. That's what I did in this most recent grant. And I happened to be lucky. To some extent I was lucky because I got to someone just, they already knew what they were applying for in terms of scientific research, but they hadn't, their budget wasn't set in stone, so they couldn't include me. So it was lucky in that sense, but it was not luck in the sense that I was ready to be able to offer them something. And anybody that's getting money from the NSF, and I'm sure other agencies as well, I highly encourage people to think about this. You find someone who's going to be applying for money from the NSF, and you'd say, hey, would you like me to be part of your broader impacts? And that could involve any kind of science you're interested in reporting on, any kind of science that someone is trying to get a grant for. Yeah. I could tell you more, between sessions or something.
Okay, we have a little less than 15 minutes. Just raise your hand if you have a question now. So I want to cycle through them a little faster because we've got several questions I want to get to. So next over there.
My name is Bear Guerra. I'm a freelance photographer and also a Scripps Fellow. Dan, I have a question for you. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about fundraising as an individual versus using a fiscal sponsor or even establishing one's own nonprofit. I've gone the individual route. I've had some of the smaller grants at SEJ, Pulitzer Center grant as well, but I'm aware that you can only get so much when you're applying as an individual. It sounds like, I'm not sure if you have done, if you primarily raise your funds as an individual or if you do use a fiscal sponsor. So I'm wondering if you could talk about that distinction a little bit and how you've gone about it.
Yeah. Well, most foundations won't give to individuals, so you need to have a fiscal agent. And I was the first person to use the Pulitzer Center as my fiscal agent. I think that they have since, other people have since gone to them, although I don't know that for sure. Yeah, I do know someone else who's done that. So I've gotten some small grants from the Pulitzer Center, but that's generally not my relationship with the Pulitzer Center. There are lots of, there are, basically, for those who aren't don't know about this, any nonprofit can be your fiscal agent. They receive the grant, and then they give the money to you. They're a pass through, and you could use any number of institutions as your fiscal agent, and you need to think about. Whether their goals are aligned with yours, whether they've got a reputation that would help you, how much they're going to charge. They generally charge a percentage to administer the money, there are other. I've continued working with the Pulitzer Center over a number of years in this way, but there are other institutions that I might have used that would be equally good. And there are some that specialize in doing this. Actually, there's an institution. There's one for filmmakers. This kind of model of fundraising is much more common for documentary filmmakers. And, I mean, if you look at the credits in a documentary film, you'll see all the places that have given the money. And so there are places that specialize in doing this for filmmakers, but they've branched out. And so you might want to look into that if you're looking for a fiscal agent. But you also might find a fiscal agent that deals in your subject matter. So if you've got a specific area of environmental reporting, there might be some nonprofit that says, "Hey, this is we could do this. We could be partner with you and help you with that." Okay.
Thanks. I'm Karen Schaefer, a freelance journalist based out of Northeast Ohio. And Daniel, I once was one of the contest judges for one of your documentaries on climate change. I don't remember what it was, Communicator Awards some years ago. I said, you should win, and you did. Just a brief mention, Jennifer asked me if I would. I used SEJ this year as my fiscal agent for a small grant that I got from a foundation in Cleveland. So, you know, think about SEJ. My question, though, has more to do, you know, you both have talked about a little bit about how you have built up your niche and how you have sort of broadened your package to include a lot of things. I'm trying to do the same thing myself, but my real issue right now is finding the outlets. And I wondered if maybe you could both talk a little bit more. It sounds as though you have a real connection with WBUR in Boston. I have some public radio connections in the Great Lakes region too, but I'm curious, you know, how do you go out and you talk to strangers, or what do you do?
I think you do have to go out and talk to strangers some. Some of the best things I'm doing now are because they approach me. One of them is a blogger at Car Talk at NPR, Click and Clack, and they just called me because I write a lot about green cars, and they didn't have that on their site, so that was very useful. But I think I did approach a lot of things, and I certainly did get turned down by a lot of people, and I got the no reply, which I don't think I ever sent a query to a Rolling Stone that I got a reply to. So I wrote one story for Men's Journal, and they didn't return. Actually, they changed editors, and you know, that can often be fatal because you were the last editor's golden boy. I think you do have to. If you don't have the connections now, I do think you have to build them, and you basically have to get lucky. You have to. I think events like this are really good for meeting people who have the power to hire you. The more networking you do at the SEJ conference, the more you're going to meet editors that will now have know who you are and will respond when you send a query. Or other events like this, I think, are really helpful.
Well, let me clearly having a reputation helps, and this is the sort of thing that builds up over time. I believe, though, that the poor financial situation of most media is actually helpful to you if you're for you as a freelancer, if you can offer something to them they can't otherwise get. So nobody has any money for travel anymore, right? So if you happen to be able to report from some place you have an exciting story and they can't otherwise get it, you're immediately of interest to them. So you're giving them you're helping them. They're in a tight spot getting good material, and you're helping them. It's not the other way around, where you're just hoping they're going to help you. It is important to it is the one really the one the one of the worst things about the whole query process for me. I always hoped when I started magazine writing that I would just meet some editors or get introduced to some editors and then just have return business, and it would make the whole thing a lot smoother. That never worked for me. In the approach that I've taken now, it's a little bit more like that, where because I've made this work for them before. Going off to Peru, where they just, unless they have somebody there, let's say the World, if they've got someone in Peru that's doing this kind of reporting, then maybe they wouldn't be interested. But for them to be able to get a piece from Peru, which is essentially free to them, there's no travel money, they're very excited about that. So then the next time around, rather than writing a complicated proposal, I can call the editor up on the phone or send him a quick email saying, well, I'm thinking about going to the Himalayas. I've got this story A, B, and C in mind. Are any of these of interest to you? And one last thing, I'm always looking for new potential outlets, and I do just introduce myself, and try to make them feel like I can solve a problem for them.
Just to add a quick note on that, many of you know this already, but since you've mentioned The World a couple of times, Dan, Peter Thompson, who's the environmental editor for The World at WBUR in Boston, or GBH, excuse me, in Boston, is an SEJ board member and is here at this meeting somewhere or will be. So when you meet editors here, you know, find out who they buy from. What are you looking for? I mean, this is a great chance when you're here for 4 days with lots of editors and producers here to find out where they get their stuff. So next question. This may be the last question. Let's see how it goes.
Hi, I'm Chandra Whitfield, and I'm also a Scripps Fellow. And you all have kind of touched on some of the questions that I had, so I apologize for any duplication. But I have found that publications tend to be very cliquish. Like, you know, of course, have your name out there, but there are a lot of accomplished writers who've done things. So how do you sort of break through into the clique, as I call it, to get to these editors, because sometimes they just kind of want to work with the people that they know and that they have continued to work with? And then also, you all mentioned a lot of funds out there. How do you identify which organizations, nonprofits, governments, et cetera, that are doing this funding?
Just in terms of breaking through, I think this is where we get into the excellence of your pitch letter. And we are going to be doing a session on that and evaluating pitches, so we can probably look at that. But I do think you have to make them as exciting as possible and as grabby as possible. And to me, the best feature pitches really contain the flavor of the finished piece. You know, that it contains some of the, probably some paragraphs or some description that is actually going to be in the piece. I've read about somebody pitching the New Yorker, where it sounds like they basically write the whole piece, and that's the pitch. And really, all they have to do is enlarge it a little bit when they get the actual assignment. And that's probably fairly extreme, but I think you do want to have more than the concept in mind when you pitch, especially if you want to cut through all the other noise that's out there. You need to have your pitch be very focused and colorful and readable, because editors read a lot of them.
I empathize with you, because I have felt that same way, and I still feel that same way. There's no doubt about it, and I think that Jim's exactly right. If you're not part of the clique, you just have to find a way to distinguish yourself as much as possible. In terms of finding money, I think you just need to. You need to see what other people have done. I mean, you need to look at, if you, you know, figure, look at. I mean, there are places that you can do research. On foundations, you can look at where other people have gotten their money by looking at the credits of whatever the project is, the acknowledgments. You can look at the SEJ resources. There are there's a grants section, grants and awards or something like that. All those things.
One more quickie. All right then. Coffee and back at 10:30.